So, welcome everybody. Well, not really welcome everybody, nobody here right now. Anyway, this is the second lecture in my course, Tranquility and Insight in Early Buddhist Discourse. And I wanted to start by apologizing for several technical problems, and I think we might also have a technical problem right now because I saw that there's over 37 people somewhere in Olat, but it seems nobody has found the way to the connect room where the lecture is starting. The other technical problems we had, for which I would like to apologize, is that when I send out the email at the beginning of the year informing you of this year's course and the registration period, it seems that many people did not get that email. Then there were some problems with logging in. And for the guest lecture, which we had last week, originally there was no audio available. But Christian Kreitschmann, who is my help and support in running this course from the e-learning administration of the University of Hamburg, has kindly produced an audio for us, which I uploaded today. Then another problem was with the lecture by Bhikkhu Bodhi, that at the end it got a little bit cut off. Actually, at that point, he was saying only that now he has said everything, and then he started a kind of personal discussion with me. And the problem is, this is something I haven't really fully figured out in this Connect registration, when there's a discussion, when we actually have the discussion, we can hear each other at proper times. But in the recording, there's a kind of a time shift a little bit. And so either there are long gaps or there's an overlap. So this last discussion part couldn't really be followed properly if you heard the video. And when I tried to edit that out, I accidentally also cut off the very last word where Bhikkhu Bodhi just says, this is it for now. But so nothing content-wise has really been lost to you. And another thing was that, I mean, I'm just extremely grateful that Bhikkhu Bodhi was willing to give this lecture. And knowing that he's very busy, I didn't ask him to also be present online on the forum and reply to any questions you might have. And so some of the questions, and that was really beautiful, there was a lot of very interesting questions and discussion on the forum. Some of the questions I will now give an answer myself, but others I'll have to leave because these were kind of very specific on what he presented. And yeah, so these were the technical problems. And I just wanted to say that Christian Kreitschmann, who has been helping me here in the chat, there's another link he has given. So in case there should be too many participants present live, which is not a problem we are going to have today, it seems. Anyway, in case that ever happens, there is this link where you could go and meet him, and if anything like the audio stops for you or the video stops or something, then it would always be possible to go there and he would be able to help you. Yeah, so that was on the technical problems. Then just one other general announcement I wanted to make is that for those of you who may not have been with us the last 2 years, Tranquility and Insight is the central topic for this course, but it's not the only topic. The thing is that we are going to read through the 7th chapter of the Madhyama Agama. And when I read through it myself, I identified Tranquility and Insight as like a main topic in this chapter. And this is why also we had this wonderful introductory lecture by Bhikkhu Bodhi to get us really clarified on some essential aspects of that topic. But during the next, we have another 10 lectures, we will sometimes also be touching on different subjects, basically because that is what we find in this chapter of the Madhyama Agama. Okay, so now I'm going to look at some of the comments and things that were said in the forum. Again, thanks to Christian that we have switched from the blog to the forum. I think the forum is just much nicer than the blog we were using the past years. So the first comment I wanted to reply on is by Boris Divjak. And it was on the overall topic of science and science in its relation to our practice. And yeah, my own take on that subject is very much to see contemplation, meditation also as a somewhat scientific approach. In fact, last year I was at the Mind and Life at Garrison in New York, which is precisely an initiative of giving a platform for dialogue between natural sciences and contemplative sciences. And I found that very inspiring to be discussing with physicists and other people from natural science, especially psychologists, and to find that common ground, which I would define as being this attempt to know and see things as they really are, yatha bhuta jnana dasana, which is what really also informs particularly insight meditation practice. And my own vision there is that it is crucially important for Buddhists to be open to the development in modern sciences and the findings of modern sciences, and to come to a dialogue between science and religion where each is trying to really understand what the other has to say, but on an equal level, not one looking down on the other, and not one trying to authenticate him or herself by findings from the other field. And my own work is also very much related to that. I mean, apart from being involved in a research on mindfulness with some psychologists, I think this course here also is pretty much exactly about that. In the sense that what I'm trying to do with you is precisely to have this dialogue between, and this is in some way what my personal life is about, being a university professor and researcher and at the same time a meditating Buddhist monk, to have this dialogue between science and religion as an exchange. And in order for this course also to reflect this type of dialogue properly, there's something that I already mentioned briefly in my welcome message. I said there, another request regarding the online discussion is that in order to honor the fact that this course is hosted by a university, we would be very grateful if you could avoid making publicity for or providing links to pages with non-academic content. So I'm repeating this one more time, just with really as a request to all of you. You see, the forum and the discussion that we have is really meant for the topics raised in the course and for your personal take on it. And that is wonderful, really, your personal opinion, how you struggle with certain subjects and topics, how you see certain things, but it is not meant to give links to say this and this teacher, oh yeah, you can look here and he says that or she says that, because if we get into that direction, we are actually a little bit leaving the academic ground and it becomes more like Buddhists online internet meeting exchange opinion thing. There's nothing wrong about that, but I would just like to ask you that we all keep in mind this is an academic university course, and what we are trying to do is to meet, to have these two aspects meet. So whatever is from you personally, this is wonderful, your practice, your understanding, but let us leave aside, let us not bring in things that are not really from an academic perspective, not by somebody who has a PhD who lectures at the university or something, and which are also not from your own personal experience and take. So that was my comment on, or my associations perhaps, on what Boris Divjak had said. Then another topic I wanted to reply on is by Dieter Möller. I think I better paste this into the chat. So I'm not entirely sure if I fully got the point he was trying to make, but he was connecting to the fact that Bhikkhu Bodhi in his introductory lecture had mentioned the Four Noble Truths. And so he says the statement, suffering in brief is for khanda attachment, this links to the law of dependent origination in which the khandas are embedded. Yeah, and there is, I just felt I would like to comment on this in order to clarify what I see as a recurrent interpretation of the relationship of the five aggregates to the 12 links of dependent origination or arising, which is not really correct. One is, there's a book here by Mathieu Bourvais on the five aggregates, and what he basically says, I'm simplifying, is basically he's trying to see how the 12 links of dependent arising kind of lead onto the five aggregates. He tries to match them, and I think there's a basic misunderstanding in that, you see, these 12 links, every moment of these 12 links, all of the five aggregates have to be there, yeah? So, ignorance is not something that happens on its own, but it happens within some five aggregates. And the next one, formation, sankhara, how you like to translate it, these sankharas, when these sankharas based on ignorance arise, they arise as part of five aggregates. There is consciousness there, there is perception, feeling, as long as it happens within the sensual realm or the fine material realm, there is some kind of a body there. And consciousness, again, consciousness is not by itself. Every moment of the five aggregates, we have these, every moment of the 12 links, we have these five aggregates there. Yeah? So, if you visualize it as the 12 links as a vertical cut and the aggregates as a horizontal cut, I think then we get the picture. And there's another thing I wanted to comment on. This is something that has been recently published by Stephen Batchelor. He came out with an article last year on secular Buddhism. And he has this basic statement. Maybe I just paste in the two statements. So he basically says that craving is what arises from dukkha rather than the other way around. He turns it around. And then he says the problem with craving is not that it causes suffering or dukkha, although obviously sometimes it does, but that it prevents one from entering the Eightfold Path, which then leads him to the idea that the ceasing of craving gives rise to the Eightfold Path. Yeah, and I think this is a very interesting interpretation, but it has no support in the suttas. In fact, I have already sent him my comments, and we are discussing on it, and I think he he also sees my point. The basis on which he makes the suggestion is again relating the five aggregates and the 12 links of dependent arising. So what he says is basically in the first noble truth, the five aggregates are identified as dukkha. Then with that understanding, he approaches the 12 links of dependent arising and says, look, the five aggregates are there, consciousness, name and form, and a little bit later feeling. So what is identified as dukkha leads on to craving, because craving is a later link in the 12 link presentation. And so my take on this is that this doesn't work, because it means that out of the whole set of 12 links, we just take out the middle part without looking at the beginning and the end. The point is that the beginning point is ignorance. And we can't leave that out, because when we leave it out, we get the Arahant. And the Arahant still has consciousness, name and form. The Arahant still has the five aggregates. And these five aggregates are dukkha. They are not fully satisfying. But these five aggregates will not lead on to craving. And if you look at the end point of the 12 links, we also find that that craving then leads on to the arising of this whole mass of dukkha. So it's very clear that in the traditional 12-link presentation, the idea is not that craving arises from dukkha, but rather that dukkha arises from craving. And in the suttas, there's only one discourse, to my knowledge, that explicitly takes up the question of what arises from dukkha, what does dukkha lead on to. And here I'm giving you the reference. This is in the Nidana Samyutta, and it's called the Upanisa Sutta. It's a very beautiful one. There's an excellent publication by Bhikkhu Bodhi in 1980 in BPS. You can just download it from the internet on Transcendental Dependent Arising, where he discusses that in detail. So this Upanisa Sutta, it works through the 12 links, and then from dukkha, it leads on to saddha, to faith or confidence. Not dukkha, not the craving, but saddha. And from saddha to joy and seeing things as they really are, and to liberation. So it shows that what dukkha conditions, can condition, not in the case of everybody, but the only thing which it is actually being shown to condition in the canonical sources is saddha, not craving. And there's a Chinese parallel in the Madhyama Agama, our collection, so we will come to that. And also a Tibetan parallel, which make exactly the same point. So that was on the topic of the Four Noble Truths. And I think there's still one more topic on rebirth I would like to take up, and then then we can see if there's any questions. But also, I mean, whenever you have a question, you can just type it in. I will see something's happening and I can take up the question. There's something that was mentioned by Robert Grosch. He says, he's kind of wondering how important it is to have already cultivated insight up to a certain degree in order to be able in this life to progress. So he puts it in whether you have to be a once returner in the previous human existence to gain arahantship in this very life. And there's a very nice reply to this from Lisa Fancutt. She says, for me, it all works in the here and now, and that's good enough. But as I go more deeply into trying to understand the Buddhist pedagogy, and Buddhism as a religion, I start to wonder why these things were or are important, why this hierarchy of rebirths from a practice fruit or practice perspective. Yeah, so first thing, my own impression is that the emphasis on practice done in past lives is something not very prominent in early Buddhism, but much rather something that becomes more and more prominent with later tradition. And there's a paper on arahantship by somebody, I don't recall the name offhand, but I have quoted him also in my book on the genesis of the bodhisattva idea, which you can just download from the internet. And there I'm showing this same perspective for the Buddha, which is, I think the Arahant paper is by George Bond. I have to look it up. Even in the case of the Buddha, if we strictly look at early Buddhism, means the discourses in the Pali Nikayas and their Chinese, Sanskrit and Tibetan parallels, which I argue are our sources for the earliest period of Buddhism from the lifetime of the Buddha up to, say, King Ashoka, the idea that the Buddha himself prepared himself over many past lives in order to become a Buddha is not found. Even in the case of the Buddha, it seems, as this is what I argue in that book also, that this idea that at some point in the past he took a vow to become a Buddha, and then for many lives he practiced such and such qualities in order to be able to become a Buddha, seems to be a later development. A very early later development shared by all Buddhist traditions, but still not exactly what we get in the early Buddhist discourses. So, coming to the practical perspective, I think for those of us who are interested in practicing meditation, the issue of how far we have already progressed in the past lives is something I suggest that can safely be set aside. That's not really the question. The question is simply, where am I now and what can I make out of this situation? So I fully agree with Lisa's comment. For me, it all works in the here and now, and that's good enough. Yeah, that is precisely the point. However, and as I've just been talking about Stephen Batchelor, I think it is also important to recognize that the early Buddhist teachings are clearly embedded in a context of rebirth. I don't think that can be denied. And there's again, we have been discussing about that, I think, already earlier in previous lectures. There's always this question of, like, let me understand what early Buddhism has to say on a particular topic, one thing, and another thing, what do I do with that? So the fact that it clearly, early Buddhist teachings are based on the vision of rebirth, on the idea that after this life there is another life and I could be reborn in as a human but also in other forms, heaven and hells. This needs to be fully acknowledged in order for us to be really able to understand what early Buddhism is teaching. But this does not mean that somebody who comes to Buddhism, this is like a requirement, you have to believe this in order for you to be able to work with Buddhist doctrine of meditation. There's no question of any kind of belief that has to be accepted as a precondition in order for anybody to be able to engage in the practice. So, yeah, I think it all works in the here and now is the kind of answer that I would give, and at the same time allow for the fact and clearly see the conditionality of the teachings also, that they arise within a certain kind of historical context where the question of rebirth was of central importance, and see how this has influenced the teachings. So there is a question from Pia Nobernat. Is it necessary to believe to engage fully in the practice up until Nibbana? I definitely do not think that it is necessary to believe in rebirth in order to be able to engage fully in the practice up until the attainment of stream entry. That is really not necessary. And if you look at Kalama Sutta, it really gives you that sense of engaging in practice and letting certain aspects of the teaching simply be as they are, but without immediately taking them on board. In fact, when I teach Satipatthana meditation, I usually give a lot of emphasis in the third Satipatthana, contemplation of the mind, to be aware not only of the mind that has a defilement, lust, anger, distraction, but to make a conscious effort to recognize when the mind is free from defilement. I have a mind right now which is free from anger and free from desire. Wow, fantastic. That's a momentary taste of freedom. And consciously cultivating that recognition of a momentary taste of freedom is what gives us a foretaste of the goal that we are moving towards. And it's something very tangible, very practical, very direct in the here and now. And there's no need to talk about rebirth, no need to have an exact understanding of what Nibbana or Nirvana may mean. But it's something that's very tangible and very clear. So my reply to that would definitely be it's not necessary to accept the whole teaching on board. It's also not necessary to reject it all, but simply let it be as it is and take that part that is meaningful. Now I come to another topic. That was by Kim. Kim Allen, she said, I thought I heard Venerable Bodhi make the point that samadhi and samatha are not etymologically related. I would welcome further information on how these terms and the practice they represent are understood to be related. Can they be used as synonyms in some cases, and when not? And Michael Beisert also was on this topic. There's another word that usually is translated as tranquility, pasaddhi, which is part of the seven factors of enlightenment. Those seven factors also include samadhi. Another question in my mind, how is samatha related to pasaddhi? Are we talking about the same mental quality? Yeah, these are very good questions, and now I'm obviously in trouble. I have some time to think about a good answer. No, the thing basically is that in the thought world of the early discourses, terms are used that have a considerable overlap in meaning. And the attempt to clearly define and set apart is something, again, that is more prominent in later tradition. So, correct, samadhi and samatha and as well pasaddhi are not etymologically related. Samadhi is this, as Bhikkhu Bodhi explained to us, this kind of bringing together, samadhiyati, and samadhi is from sham. So it has this basic idea of tranquility, or Bhikkhu Bodhi prefers to translate it as serenity. At the same time, however, all these terms have a considerable overlap. And I don't think it would be possible to say, oh, okay, all of this is only samadhi, and all of this is only samatha. What, to me, is particularly striking about samatha, one of the two terms that we will be recurrently discussing in this course, and to which we will be coming, I think, later today when we look at the first Madhyama Agama discourse, is this very general sense of tranquility. The word samatha, for example, comes up in the Vinaya, in the monastic code of discipline, under something called Adhikarana Samatha. This is the when there is an issue that leads to a litigation or a dispute, how you can tranquilize that. So this is not really that much to do with sitting in deep samadhi, but simply how can I introduce this basic quality of samatha, of tranquility, in a situation where there is a problem within the monastic community. Somebody is being breaking the rules and not maybe wanting to admit it, or these kind of things. And so the sense we get from that is that samatha has a very general range of reference. And again, coming back to the actual practice, this means that there is a broad range of activities where we could cultivate this quality of tranquility. And if I look at it from that perspective, then when this tranquility becomes something very meditative, something that affects body and mind, I could then call it passaddhi, passaddhi as an awakening factor. And both of these qualities have something to do with being bringing things together, samadhi. But samadhi is usually a term that we would use for more meditative contexts. Yeah, that is my take on samatha. Then on the term vipassana. Steve Rosalik, he says, if I'm not mistaken, I believe that he said, that Bhikkhu Bodhi said, that the foundations of mindfulness are not synonymous with vipassana, but could be used as suitable objects for developing samatha or samadhi. Can you or he elaborate on the difference between the four foundations of mindfulness and vipassana? Yeah, I think the basic point is, and I discussed that in my book on Satipatthana, this direct path, page 61 and following, that cultivation of mindfulness has a very important function to support the development of concentration or tranquility. And here is another comment by Teresa Peter about the use of the term vipassana. She says, sometimes I feel that it is used as companion to samadhi. Then at other times I read the term vipassana as a label for different meditation schools or traditions. Is the observation correct that sometimes vipassana is used in a broad sense, including all aspects of the threefold training? And at other times it is used in a more focused sense, indicating one aspect of the threefold training. Yeah, so my own take, and this is going to be a little bit a topic that to it will be coming back again and again, is that as far as I can see in early Buddhist discourse, vipassana is a quality. It's a quality similar to what I just described about samatha. So, it's a quality you could even develop now, hopefully, while listening to what I say or studying the discourses. And we can also have the quality samatha right here in the fact that I'm not agitated and moving around, but trying to be calm and talk in a calm manner. So, it is really a quality that can be developed with a broad range of situations. But obviously in both case of samatha, tranquility and vipassana insight, the question is to build that foundation in general situations so that then based on this foundation, these qualities can be developed in a meditative setting. And then that these qualities developed in a meditative setting lead up to liberation. With later tradition, and this is the usage of vipassana that we usually come across in modern days, the word vipassana usually means a particular meditation technique. Not so much a quality, but a particular meditation technique. And often enough, then the type of technique that my tradition and my teacher teaches, which is of course the only one that really works, at least some people have this attitude. Yeah, so this is the basic shift of meaning in the term of vipassana as far as I can see. I am not so clear about it being used for all aspects of the threefold training explicitly, but as I said, to some degree, all aspects of the threefold training can be seen from the perspective of leading to samatha or vipassana. So we have this whole range of activities that can ideally be cultivated in order to bring into being these two essential qualities. And these two qualities have been described in one discourse as two messengers, and this is a question by Jeff Hardin. He says, the King Sukhachri Sutra, and he gives the reference for us, gives the frontier city simile. Here serenity and insight are a swift pair of messengers who bring to the king, symbolic for consciousness, the message of Nibbana via the route of the Noble Eightfold Path and guided by mindfulness. This simile suggests that both serenity and insight are necessary to carry the message. That is, both are needed to gain awakening. This strikes me as odd. When I think of a messenger, I always think of a solitary messenger bringing the message. There is no explanation as to why there are many messengers, not just two or one. Do you have any thoughts on this? Yeah, so we have a Chinese parallel and a Tibetan parallel, and here I'm giving you the reference to the Chinese. The Chinese has only one messenger, only the messenger of insight. But the Tibetan has two messengers. The Tibetan agrees with the Pali that there are two messengers, insight and serenity, or insight and tranquility. And I find this very interesting to have this difference. In fact, I have a book coming out now on Satipatthana, and it will come out by the end of the year, and I'm translating the Chinese version. And to me, it is a little difficult to take sides with one of these two different modes of presentations. In fact, my own take on it is that they kind of almost complement each other. Because, as some of you on the forum also mentioned, the really decisive quality is insight. There is no doubt about that. It is insight which cuts through the defilements. It is insight which leads to realization. But at the same time, as far as I can see, and this is a topic to which we will be coming next, is that in early Buddhism, insight is not seen as something that takes place in the absence of tranquility, but much rather both qualities, I stress again, we are talking about qualities, not about separate meditation techniques, both qualities need to be brought into being. They support each other, even though it is only one who is responsible for the final job of cutting through defilements. So, for me personally, a pair of messengers is beautiful, a single messenger is also beautiful. Yeah, then there was much discussion on the Yogananda Sutta. And in fact, when I looked at the forum this early morning, I thought, oh, I have to restructure my lecture. And as you can see here on the screen, we're going to look at the Yogananda Sutta and also the Chinese version, which was not really planned. But I think it is important for us to, first of all, really look at those topics that Bhikkhu Bodhi has so beautifully brought up, to have a clear take on these qualities before embarking in our reading of the Madhyama Agama. So, I will first again put in some of the questions and points made by some of you, give short replies, and then we look together at the Pali and Chinese version of the Yogananda Sutta. This is Robert Grosch. He says, from a practitioner's viewpoint, is it that the conditions conducive to fruitful vipassana meditation also automatically produce the necessary amount of samatha? Or do I do something like metta meditation on the side of the vipassana practice in order to condition the mind such that the necessary samatha arises in my vipassana practice? Yeah, so my own understanding is that while it is certainly true that the practice of insight on its own, because it leads to detachment and letting go, will naturally increase our tranquility, our calmness. Inasmuch as meditation practice is concerned, I would very much encourage the conscious cultivation of some degree of samatha. And here I think the example that Robert has given of metta meditation is particularly apt. There's a whole host of problems that I'm also involved in one research project in a distant manner on problems arising from meditation. Particularly Westerners with a not really integrated sense of who they themselves are and some mental tendencies that would probably best be addressed in a psychotherapeutic setting. If these are put into a situation of intensive insight meditation, can really lead to problems, to mental problems. And my personal feeling is that much of this could be avoided if the cultivation of samatha were to be made an integral aspect of one's practice. And here I personally see in particular metta meditation as particularly powerful. Metta is the cultivation of an attitude of friendliness, friendshipness, goodwill, loving kindness, benevolence towards myself and everyone else. And this has such a strong integrating impact on our practice that it gives a solid foundation and a counterbalance to the cultivation of insight. And moreover, metta meditation, which we discussed a little bit in the course last year, by the very fact that if we practice it according to the early Buddhist instructions where we are talking about a radiation in all directions, an opening of the heart, a spaciousness of the mind that is full with benevolence, metta, this experience in itself is already a foretaste of temporary liberation of the mind, citta vimutti, and is in itself already such a gain to be in that condition that a problem that sometimes can arise with other samatha objects, this goal-orientedness, this feeling that I must get jhana, unless I get jhana I haven't done it, this thing pretty much is much less prominent. It is a being metta. When I teach it, I say be metta instead of do metta. So being for some time in this condition of metta is something that I would very strongly recommend to any meditation practitioner. Not wanting to put it down as so much of this and so much of that. This is really up to one's own preferences, one's own situation. But to make the conscious cultivation of samatha, samatha as a quality in everyday life, my trying to remain calm when, I don't know, I'm driving my car through the city to go to work and other people are being in a rush and I try to remain calm when somebody is shouting at me, when I have stress. And also when I sit down to meditate, by having this basic attitude of friendliness, friendshipness, goodwill, benevolence towards myself and anyone else, is something very, very useful. Then here there is a longer comment by Benjamin Steffens. So he connects to what Robert Grosch had said and says, I too have difficulties to understand how serenity preceded by insight is developed. From the explanation of the Venerable Bodhi, I understood that on this way one basically uses a form of insight meditation to gain a more or less superficial insight into phenomena, at which point one either realizes that one needs to develop serenity in order to deepen the insight, or one develops a certain kind of serenity more or less automatically or by accident when developing concentration during the insight meditation. Then he quotes two discourses from Anguttara in 493 and 494. Though the Buddha explains that there are persons who gain higher wisdom but not internal serenity of mind. From that it seems that internal serenity may precede higher wisdom while not necessitating it. And then he comments, gaining a certain rather superficial wisdom through conscious reflection and additional insight meditation, and then developing serenity afterwards in order to make progress, that seems plausible. Gaining higher wisdom without serenity, though, does not. Yeah, I thought that was a very interesting comment. I just put in again the term that is used in these discourses, Adipanya Dhamma Vipassana. I think it is clear that these discourses do envisage the possibility that somebody can develop higher wisdom, insight into phenomena without having fully established a basis in meditative tranquility or serenity. And I think it is this is significant. And this is the topic to which we will be coming with the Yogananda Sutta, which we'll be discussing soon. As far as I can see, I fully understand while some eminent meditation teachers stress the importance of tranquility as something that is really a necessary foundation, because it's really such an important quality. I fully also understand why some teachers emphasize the importance of insight, because it's, again, such an important quality. But my personal feeling is that in the early suttas, both are qualities to be developed, and the sequence in which we develop them is not prescribed. The Yogananda Sutta, to which we will be coming soon, says you can do one and then the other, or you can do the other and then the one. It does not say this. There is only this one way. And I think that is actually very beautiful. It's a very open thing. And this is also my understanding of the way meditation is really taught in early Buddhism, that there's this, all these tools are spread out, and then the practitioner is left to himself, to herself, to take these tools and practice. There's always these situations where there's some monk comes to the Buddha and I really want to do it now. I really want to go and meditate and I want to get it. So what happens? Does the Buddha say, come here, this is my meditation center, this is the daily schedule, and this is the technique, right? You practice only this technique because this is the only possible way to get it, and you must be very precise to really follow my instructions. And every day in the afternoon, we will have a private meeting, and there will be an interview. I will check what happened in your meditation, give you advice. Nothing of that. All the Buddha does, according to the suttas, in such situations, is he gives them a topic, something like, don't crave, or don't cling to anything. He seems to know that person, or is aware, able to assess what is the particular problem of this meditator. And he gives them one sentence, two sentences, and they go off, and after a few months they come back, Panta, I've done it. That's a completely different way of handling meditation compared to what seems to often be prominent in modern day times. Just give the basic tools, and then let those who want to practice cultivate their own wisdom, cultivate their own understanding by using these tools and monitoring, is this good for me, is this not good for me, does this work, does this not work. There is these situations where the Buddha chances on a group of monks and he asks them, do you practice mindfulness of breathing? How do you practice it? You see, he doesn't even know how they were practicing it. In the sense that he has not apparently given a fixed script, this is how meditation should be done, no other way. But he simply gives them this 16-step model, and some may be practicing it, some may not be practicing it. There's so much freedom there. The same with contemplation of death, recollection of death. He asks them, you practice recollection. How do you practice it? It gives the, really this impression that there was a lot of room for initial personal initiative in cultivating the practice. And so coming back to tranquility and insight, it is really up to where a particular practitioner stands at a particular time, how he and she is cultivating the path to find what works best for them. And just to be aware that the ultimate goal is a position of balance. So if this particular quality, say insight, is the one that I'm really drawn to and that works for me, well, that's fine. But let me make an effort to bring in some tranquility whenever that fits the practice, and vice versa. So, question here by Dhammadina. Majjhima Nikaya 43, right view is assisted, aided by both tranquility and insight together in order to get to full liberation. This would indicate that these are qualities, as you say, supporting right view. Yeah, exactly. Thank you for the quote. Then here is a comment by Eric van Horn. Ananda's discourse on the four paths to enlightenment, that is the Yogananda Sutta that we will be discussing, is used as the theoretical basis for dry insight, that is to say enlightenment without jhana. But in the Majjhima Nikaya, as I read it, jhana is a prerequisite to attaining enlightenment. I'm wondering if this discourse of Ananda also exists in the Agamas or if it only appears in the Pali Canon. My second question is about the relationship between tranquility and insight practices. In the Majjhima Nikaya, my understanding is that these two qualities are cultivated together, more or less. Whereas in the Visuddhimagga, there's a sharper distinction between them as separate practice. Is that a correct characterization? Yeah. Yeah, it very much resonates with me. This is again the point, and I like the way Eric puts it. This is really the point that I was trying to make before, that two qualities that are cultivated together is what we get in early Buddhism, and with later tradition we get these almost like separate camps. Regarding the first part of Eric's question, I am not sure if the Yogananda Sutta can be seen as a basis for dry insight. And this is something we will be coming back very soon. But much rather, I would see it as a basis for the claim that the two qualities have to be combined. And the Yogananda Sutta does exist in Chinese, and you will be getting a few excerpts from it. The question of enlightenment without jhana, or I personally prefer awakening, because bodhi comes from buddhiti, to awaken, and several scholars have pointed out that the term really means to wake up and has nothing to do with the European movement of enlightenment. It has also nothing so much to do with the idea of light, but more with really like waking up to see reality as it really is. The issue of jhana and awakening is, as most of you probably know, a hotly debated issue, and I have ventured to take my position on that in my Satipatthana book. As far as I can see, first of all, the suttas are not very clear on this, which in itself is, I think, significant. The point is, what is required is samatha. But the level of samatha required is not so clearly stipulated. And only realizing that takes off a lot of burden from actual practice, because it becomes clear that what is required for us is to develop tranquility or calmness in a general sense. But how deep this goes in our actual practice, and whether it qualifies jhana according to so-and-so's definition and so-and-so's definition and so-and-so's definition, is something a little bit more secondary. Anyway, my own understanding of the relevance of jhana according to how I can see the early Buddhist discourses is that this becomes a requirement for the higher two paths, non-return and arahantship. And I have given the arguments for that in my Satipatthana book. Now, I don't want to we do that whole discussion, and I'm certainly not claiming that I got it right and everybody else who doesn't agree with me got it wrong. I'm just saying this is my personal take. And for those of you who wish to go over these kind of arguments, please check my Satipatthana book, page 79 following. And feel totally free to disagree with me. And there's a comment by Lisa Fancott. She says the samatha, vipassana confusion, some schools were saying one before the other, excuse me, or one not the other. In fact, many schools were saying the opposite from the other. And then she says, when I was trying to decide whether to choose between samatha or vipassana first, I was released by seeing the interdependence. No chicken, no egg. Chicken is an egg and egg is a chicken. Yeah, I love that comment. Couldn't put it better myself. That's precisely the point. This is what I hope we take away from today's lecture. This seeing the interdependence. The chicken and egg. And there's another comment by Linda Grace, and then we get into Yogananda Sutta. She says, I can't relate to the idea of serenity and insight really being separate things, but rather more like different aspects of the same path. It seems what is being pointed to in the suttas is the importance of developing both serenity and insight, even if one aspect is initially more developed than the other. Again, I can only express my full agreement with that, that resonates very much with me. This is the way I would see it. That they are not really separate things. They are two qualities. And this is something we will see in some discourses we take up later on in this course, where really they interrelate to such an extent and reinforce each other. So they are different aspects but not separate things. And it's important to cultivate both, to point to that balance, to balance them out, but to allow our practice to evolve naturally for these qualities to naturally grow. And Linda Grace asked for the Chinese version, so yeah, I think I go for the Yogananda Sutta. Anyway, if you have any question, I have finished throwing in my quotes from the forum discussion. Thanks again to all of those who have participated on the forum. That's a very lively discussion. This is always, for me, this is the nicest part of the course, because what comes now when I start talking is what I've heard myself already saying this. But when you come out with comments, questions, the way you look at things, this is where I can learn, where I benefit. So thanks to all of you for that. So here are the central points from the Yogananda Sutta. First option, one develops insight, one develops insight preceded by tranquility. As one is developing insight preceded by tranquility, the path is generated. One pursues this path, develops it and cultivates it. As one is pursuing, developing and cultivating this path, the fetters are abandoned and the underlying tendencies are uprooted. Yeah, the first thing I would like us to notice is that this is talking about the generation of the path, stream entry. And when this path has been generated, by further cultivating, developing it, it leads up to arahantship, the abandoning of the fetters and the uprooting of the underlying tendencies. So, the approach towards the generation of the path can take place by developing tranquility first and then insight. Now, according to option 2, it can also be the other way around. One may first give emphasis to insight and then to the quality of tranquility. And the third is to have these two in conjunction, to combine them in some way. And the fourth as I read, one's mind is seized by restlessness about the Dhamma. But there comes an occasion when the mind becomes internally steady, composed, unified and concentrated. Then the path is generated. One pursues this path, develops it and cultivates it. As one is pursuing, developing, cultivating this path, the fetters are abandoned and the underlying tenses are rooted. So the second part of this quote is the same for all four. I have just abbreviated it in case 2 and case 3. Yeah, so the first two are fairly clear, I think. And they make that basic point that I've been trying to make in our discussion so far, and which Lisa and Linda had pointed out in the last quotes that we can still see in the chat, that these are the interrelation, the combination of these two qualities. The third is not entirely clear. The commentary tradition sees this as getting into a jhana, then coming out, developing insight. But my personal understanding would rather be that this should refer in some way to a combining of both qualities. There's one discourse, the Mahasala Yatanika Sutta, which uses this term, Yogananda. And I have written an encyclopedia entry on the Yogananda Sutta. This is up on the OLAT, so you can download it as a PDF, just as you can download the PDFs of these lectures and get it in more detail. My personal take on this, but this is not explicitly supported by the suttas, is that the discourses like, for example, Majjhima Nikaya 121, the smaller discourse on emptiness, also speak to me about this idea of tranquility and insight, Yogananda. But again, I must stress, this is just my personal take, and I have no basis in the suttas that would support explicitly that this is discourse, Majjhima Nikaya 121, speaks about the conjunction. But what I see in this discourse is how perceptions, sanya, that are usually cultivated in the realm of tranquility, in particular for the immaterial attainments, the arupa samapatti, boundless space, boundless consciousness, nothingness, and according to the Pali version only, also neither perception nor non-perception, are used within a gradual approach to emptiness. And they are used for insight purposes. There's an insight reflection that comes with each of these. One has the perception of boundless space. And my personal take is that as it is called a perception, it need not absolutely be the full attainment of the first immaterial sphere, although if one can get it, so much the better. And then one has this understanding, this is empty of diversification, this is empty of solidity in terms of earth, but it's not empty of the perception of space. And one sees all of these, the stages that one has practiced previously, and this attainment of this experience, this perception of boundless space, as a darata, as a thorn, a disturbance, or in the Chinese as a weariness, which introduces the quality of dukkha. So the actual meditative experience is one that we would probably want to put under the heading of samatha, of tranquility. But the purpose this is being used is for insight. And this is then a further refinement comes when from being aware of boundless space, one becomes aware of the mind that is aware of boundless space, which by having taken a boundless object becomes boundless itself, boundless consciousness. This is a shift away from concern with the outer world to looking at that which experiences the outer world, our mind, which is the ground of our experience. And again, insight is developed with that. And in this way, the sutta continues, and in the end, bringing it up to signlessness, there comes still that understanding that this too is conditioned and impermanent. So the way I understand this discourse is an example of what I personally, and I have to say it a third time, this is my personal interpretation, this is not supported by the suttas, this is just my take on it. I would put this under step number 3 of the Yuvananda Sutta. A conjunction of tranquility and insight, in as much as I'm using a tranquility type of object for insight purposes. And it is precisely that insight purposes that mark the difference between the samatha attainment of the immaterial sphere of boundless space, boundless consciousness, etc., and its use in a gradual approach to emptiness. Regarding number 4 in the Yuvananda Sutta, there is a very, very beautiful comment, excuse me, by Vairamanyana Ponikathera and Bhikkhu Bodhi in an anthology of the Anguttara Nikaya. Below you get the page references. It's note 69 on page 295. So about this fourth option in Yuvananda Sutta, they say, it is plausible, however, that the agitation or restlessness above is mental distress brought about by eagerness to realize the Dhamma, a state of spiritual anxiety that sometimes can precipitate an instantaneous enlightenment experience. For an example, see the story of Bahya Dharuchirya in Udana 110. And this, to my mind, again, they disagree with the commentarial interpretation which sees number 4, excuse me, as being related to the notion of vipassana upakkilesa, certain experiences that arise at a certain stage in the cultivation of insight, which in themselves are not positive or negative, but which become a problem when the meditator latches onto them as a something, I got it. Now I've done it. This is the final goal. But I think that the interpretation proposed here by Vairamanyana Ponika and Venerable Bhikkhu Bodhi makes more sense, and that the situation of the story of Bahya in the Udana is a very good example for us to have a practical taste of this fourth option. The story of Bahya, just very briefly said and already making a little footnote, unfortunately we have no Chinese parallel of this beautiful story. Bahya, according to the story in the Udana, was a non-Buddhist ascetic who believed himself to have reached the final goal. And then there comes a deva who tells him, look, you are not an arahant. And so he immediately says, but if I'm not an arahant, then is there somebody who can teach me how to become an arahant? And she says, it's a female deva. I don't remember. The deva says, you have to cross all the half of India. He was somewhere in the Bombay area. And to go all the way up to Shravasti, Savati, the Buddha is there, and he can teach you. And so this Bahya, who according to the commentary had done the whole range of samatha meditation, he had accomplished the 4 jhanas and also the 4 arupa attainments, he immediately sets out and he walks all over India to get to meet this person who can teach him. He arrives at Jeta's Grove and Buddha is not there, he's gone out into town to beg, and he can't wait. He goes after him and he meets him on the road. And Pante, instructions. Wait, I'm going begging. No, I want it now. Who knows how long I'm going to live? And then the Buddha gives him this, according to this discourse, this very short and succinct instruction. In the seen, there should be just the seen. In the heard, just the heard, etc. And according to this discourse, just hearing this very short instruction on simply remaining with what is experienced through the senses, without in any way reacting, elaborating, manipulating, conceptualizing it, was sufficient for this Bahya to make the breakthrough all the way to arahantship. And soon after getting these instructions, he is, by an accident, overrun by a cow, I think, and he passes away. And the Buddha tells the monks, this Bhaiya is actually a fully accomplished monk, and he's an arahant, and you should look after his remains in the proper way. So here, the one's mind is seized by restlessness about the Dhamma, so there, or agitation. Bhaiya was apparently so sincere that when he's being told, look, you think you're an arahant, but you're not an arahant, he immediately goes off and he can't wait. He wants it now. He wants to find out right away. He can't wait for the Buddha to come back to Jeta's Grove. He can't wait on the road. He wants it here and now. And with that attitude, through the instruction, he's being led to this kind of becoming composed, unified and concentrated. And the instruction teaches him that the solution is not samatha by itself, not only concentration, letting go of the senses, but opening up to this awareness at all sense doors and seeing through it. This, according to my interpretation, is what triggers his breakthrough. So this is briefly for number 3 and 4. My personal suggestion, number 3, I would see that in Majjhima Nikaya 121, Chula Sunyata Sutta, the smaller discourse on emptiness. And number 4, the suggestion by Venerable Jnanaponika Thera and Bhikkhu Bodhi, that an example for this would be the instruction to Bhaiya. And now here we have the, excuse me. The Chinese version, it reads a little differently, but it gives the basic point again. So option 1 is expressed as one settles the mind, well settles the mind, definitely settles the mind, and trains the mind in tranquility and insight. So here clearly the initial input is on the tranquility side. And the second one then is one gives attention to investigation of phenomena. This is Dhamma Vichaya, the second of the awakening factors. And through such contemplation, settles the mind, well settles it, definitely settles it, and trains it in tranquility and insight. So here clearly insight is the first quality that is being cultivated and given importance. Then we have the conjunction. And then we have being gripped by agitation, one tames the mind, definitely settling the mind, one trains in tranquility and insight. This is interesting because here, if we look back, the fourth quality in the Pali version did not explicitly mention tranquility and insight. But the Chinese version does explicitly mention it. So in the Chinese version, what comes out to my mind more clearly, without wanting to say that this is the better or more correct presentation, is this importance of cultivating both qualities. I come back to Liza's no chicken, no egg. Chicken is an egg and egg is a chicken. And to Linda's, I can't relate to the idea of serenity and insight really being separate things. That, I think, is the main point that I would like you to take along from this rather long introductory discussion, but I felt it was important for us to really look at these two qualities in the way that, according to my understanding, they are presented in the early sources as a basis for our readings. Again, if you have any questions, please type them in. And I would like to get us a little bit started on the first discourse in the 7th chapter of the Madhyama Agama now. I briefly mentioned at the beginning of the last lecture that we have been jumping. 2 years ago we did chapter 1 and 2, last year chapter 3 and 4, and now we have been jumping chapter 5 and 6. The reason for one is that the basis for this course is a translation project, and we have completed the first volume, handed in those first 6 chapters, and we were originally expecting the book to be out by the end of last year. So I was thinking when I was devising, deciding what topics and suttas to take for this course, which I did already last year, I was thinking, let me move on to the seventh chapter so that to those who come to listen to the course, they get a chance to get new material which is not yet out. But unfortunately, Numata has not published, and we don't really know when they're going to publish it. But at some point it will be out. And if I'm to be fully honest with you also, Chapter 7 and the topic of tranquility insight is just a little bit more fascinating. Chapter 5 and 6, there are a number of nice suttas, but they don't have, they're not as juicy as the ones that we have here. So I also thought for my own and for your entertainment or for your interest, it's more interesting. And anyway, we are not forced. We don't have to try to finish the whole Madhyama Agama in, I don't know how many years that would take, in fact. But the whole idea is for us, we just take up little parts, look at them, and develop our understanding, discuss them. But when we take up, then we follow the whole chapter also, because I find that if I would be only picking single discourses, we would miss out on some things. In fact, the discourse we're going to have now is a very interesting one, but the one that comes after is one that is quite different, and I'm very happy that we are pretty much forced to look at that one too. In fact, my personal hope is that you're going to be able to help me to understand that discourse a little better. But this is for next time. So let us start on the Madhyama Agama 72. I read, thus have I heard. At one time the Buddha was dwelling at Kosambi in Gocetus Park. At that time, a number of monks from Kosambi were fighting and quarreling with one another. Then the Blessed One told the monks from Kosambi, monks, don't fight and quarrel. Why? If one tries by quarreling to stop quarrel, in the end one will not see it stop. Only by patience can quarreling be stopped. This is a principle that should be honored. Why? In the bygone past, there was a king of Kosala named Long Lifespan, and there was a king of Kasi named Brahmadatta. These two kings were constantly quarreling and battling with each other. For those of you who have had a chance to look at the Pali version, we right away noticed that this story of the king Long Lifespan and the king Brahmadatta is not found in the Pali version. Here I'm abbreviating what comes next of this story. So they fight with each other and this king Long Lifespan wins. And then the same happens once again. And on the third occasion, this king Long Lifespan is kind of getting tired of this fighting and he just doesn't do anything. He says, what is the use of all this killing of people? And because he doesn't put up any resistance, his army is captured and he has to flee with his wife. And he goes to Benares, to Varanasi. He hides there for some time, but eventually he's caught and he's sent off to be executed. And on the way to his execution, he sees his son, the Prince Long Life. And here again, I'm quoting from the discourse. So he says to his son, be patient, Prince, be patient, Prince. Don't let the bondage of anger arise. Instead, you should practice loving kindness. And the story continues with this king as being killed. And the prince now wants revenge. So he enrolls in the service of King Brahmadatta without revealing his identity. And he becomes a very trusted servant of this king. And at a certain point then the two are alone out on an outing. They've gone somewhere to hunt or I don't remember. And King Brahmadatta is getting tired and he takes a nap on the knee of Prince Longlife. And Prince Longlife thinks, now my chance has come. He takes out his sword to take revenge. And just as he wants to cut off the king's head, he remembers what his father said. Be patient, Prince. Be patient, Prince. Don't let the bondage of anger rise. Instead, you should practice loving kindness. And so King Brahmadatta wakes up, and at that point Prince Longlife reveals his identity and says, look, I was just about to kill you in revenge, but then I remembered what my father said. And the king is so touched by this that he grants him, the two grant each other their life. They say, we are not going to fight with each other again. let us finish this. And King Brahmadatta even gives him his daughter in marriage and restores his former kingdom. And I have a little, after all this dry talk by me, I have a little depiction of this from, excuse me, from Nagarjunikonda. So we can see there, let me see if I can show this. There should be some error. Well, I think here. Yeah. So here you can see the parents are being led away by soldiers. These are soldiers. And this could be a soldier, or it could be the son, or this could be the son. It's not entirely clear, watching the whole scene. And here we have the king again. This is the second scene with the son being the devout servant, and here's just some of the king's wives. So this is a depiction of this story. And two things I would like us to notice. The first thing is that it is interesting that we get this whole long story in the Madhyama Agama, but not in the Majjhima Nikaya version. And we have a similar story in the Pali Vinaya related to the same Kosambi event. So this is something that alerts us again to a feature of oral transmission. And this is important. I was hoping to be able to stress this in this first lecture for those of you who may not have been with us during the last 2 years. It is important for us to understand the type of text we are dealing with. There are some of my academic friends and colleagues who think of these early discourses always in terms of redactors and editors. And all the differences they see, like this rather substantial difference where one version has this whole long story and the other one doesn't have it, there's always this feeling that there must be some reason. Why did the redactors at the editorial meeting decide to put in this story? And could it be related to the schools? This is the Sarvastivada school. Did the Sarvastivadins have a particular reason for putting in this story? Did the Theravadins have a particular reason for taking out this story? And yeah, my own study, particularly my habilitation in which I studied all the 152 discourses of the Majjhima Nikaya in the light of all their parallels, has brought me to quite a different understanding. My understanding is that these texts are really the products of oral transmission. And for us, if we want to understand them, we really have to let go of the ideas of textual production with which we are familiar from the modern day world. These texts have come into being in an oral setting. They were transmitted by oral means, and they were meant for oral performance. And this is something quite different from nowadays when we write an article, when we have an editorial meeting for some felicitation volume. This is quite different modes of textual production. And it is perfectly natural that the Kosambi event, the quarrel between the monks at Kosambi, apparently in all traditions was related to this story of this king which we have here on this picture, and this illustration of patience where he can take revenge for the unjust killing of his father and he does not do it. This relation was there in all traditions, as far as I can tell. And it is very natural that when relating this discourse, like say the original discourse just says there was the quarrel at Kosambi and then the Buddha spoke this verse. Now if I get this sutta, I learn it in an oral setting, and then I teach it to somebody else, I might just make a remark. And actually this is where the story of King Longlife or King Digayu or deity story comes in. And I pass it on to someone else, and somebody else, the next reciter in this oral transmission, then gives a little bit more details about the story. And the next one gives the full story. And a few more down the line, the distinction between this actually was the original discourse, and this is just the story given by the commentator, becomes blurred. And the comment, the story becomes part of the discourse. And this is something I have also written a paper on. And this is something very natural, and there need not be a conscious editorial decision for that. There need not be an intention behind finding these differences. And particularly, there need not be an expression of school affiliation. You see, these texts were orally transmitted for centuries before the coming into existence of Buddhist schools. So we cannot say that the differences only start once the reciters of, say, the Madhyama Agama had a conscious sense of self-identity as Sarvastivadins. Such differences could have happened at any time since the coming into being of this discourse, whenever that was, up to the time when it was translated into Chinese. And more important still, it has need not have anything to do with China. The Madhyama Agama is an Indic text that came into being in India, was transmitted in India for many centuries. And only at the very final point of its trajectory in history, it was brought to China and there translated into Chinese. And the Madhyama Agama translator was actually a Kashmirian. And in my own reading of the Agamas, I find that the Madhyama Agama is very thorough translation. And as far as I can tell, up till now, I have not found any evidence for Chinese influence in the Madhyama Agama. This is quite different from another Agama called the Ekotarika Agama, where in fact at present I am coming out with a paper where I'm showing that there have been changes in China. So basically what I'm saying is that we are probably doing justice to these texts best if we keep clearly in mind the fact that these are orally transmitted texts, that they came into being in an oral setting, and that not all differences we find between parallel versions need to be the outcome of conscious manipulations, of intentional reductions, of editors that take decisions and have preferences based on their school affiliation, or even some intermingling, some changes of the text made by the Chinese translators. And the second thing I wanted to say on this story, to round off also our discussion of tranquility and insight, is that this beautifully demonstrates the practical relevance of Samatha. This is precisely what this first part of the discourse is talking about, how to develop Samatha. This prince was cultivating Samatha, a very ordinary type of Samatha, not deep concentration, so and so jhana, but just by practicing patience and forgiveness. And cultivating this very ordinary type of tranquility is what leads a long way in having experiences based on that quality in formal meditation. So there's a question by Marta. Those remarks so natural are exactly the changes of redactors, whether the means of transmission is oral or written, it seems to me, and need not be attached to schools to reflect different perspectives or to provide clues about how the transmission worked. Marta, I'm not sure I understand exactly what you are saying. Those remarks are exactly the changes of redactors. And need not be attached to school. Okay, I think I got you now. So the point I'm trying to make is that it is better for us not to speak in terms of editors and redactors, but to speak in terms of what the sources themselves use, of banakas, of reciters. So I'm not saying that there is no intentionality at all in any way, but I'm saying that the changes that we can witness between parallel versions, the slight changes in oral retelling, need not always be based on an intentional decision of the type that a redactor or an editor would do on receiving a certain text, deciding this part has to be taken out, this part has to be reworded. I'm just trying to help us to approach the text based on a clear understanding of its genre, as oral transmission. There's a little game that we were doing as kids where we were sitting in a line, and the first person was to tell a story and whisper it into the ear of the next one. And each of us had the job to pass on the story as correctly as we can, but use our own words. And nobody else should hear it. And then, once it got through the line, say, 10 kids, the last person, the last kid, would get up and say the story aloud, and the first kid would get up and say the story aloud. And the two stories were so different. But each of us was trying to say the same thing, only using different words. So this is maybe an illustration of what I'm trying to say. The changes that happened from the first child to the last child, none of them were intentional. Our job was to pass on the story as correctly as we can, and different to the Buddhist reciters who were using the same words, our job was to use different words. And the final result was completely different. So that is the point I'm making, that we allow our working, our study of this text, to be aware of these unintentional changes and the natural influences of what you call the slight changes in oral retelling. Piano Bernard, could it be that in the recitation some stories were only cited but not explained because of being widely known by people in that time, and that is why they were not recorded in a particular sutta, and with time the reference story was forgotten? Yes, in fact, this is precisely one of the aspects that we can see. Yeah, I think Lisa is writing something. If not, then we can conclude, because the time is coming to a close. Just a comment. Amazing how little has changed given all the variables. Yeah. In fact, that is a beautiful way to conclude today's session, because that is this is a story about Einstein, how he researched for a long time, and then he came up with this very short formula to sum it up. So if I have to sum up my habilitation work, over 1,000 pages in print, don't read it. It's terribly boring. If I have to sum it up in one sentence, it's precisely what Lisa said. In spite of all these variables, all these different influences, this is amazing how close many of these suttas still are. And this gives us a very strong ground to stand on, because this really enables us to reconstruct early Buddhism. Not the Buddha's word, that is unreachable for us with academic means, but the earliest stage in the development of Buddhist philosophy and thought through comparative study of these early discourses. And really amazing how little has changed. So, that's it for today. Thank you so much for your attention, and I look forward to benefiting from the discussions on the forum during the next days, and then, yeah, to see you next week when we are going to delve into this beautiful sutta, the Upakilesa Sutta, and its Madhyama Agama parallel, to see what it can tell us about, in particular about tranquility, from the topic of samadhi in a very general sense. It gets us really into jhanas and the nimittas and all these things. So, thank you very much, and bye-bye.